Okay. First of all, it's great to have a couple of guests visiting. I don't know if guests is the right word. Great to have a bunch of people who feel hopefully very comfortable in this room coming back again. The plan today is as follows. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb was the president of Yeshiva University for many years. He's the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side. He was a little bit of a unique Torah figure. What I want to try to do is to give some insight, as again, I'm speaking about different people's perspectives on tshuva, to give some insight into a little bit who he was and what he did, even before we start talking about tshuva itself. Just understand a little bit about the kind of person or the kind of role that he, in many ways, played until his retirement a couple of years ago. First off, as follows. Rabbi Lamb is a person who is a major, major figure in a variety of different areas. He published works on Torah Lishma and the thought of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, works in Torah Sachasidus. He's a person that always wrote about issues that were relevant to that particular time. One of the first articles on an Orthodox approach to homosexuality is one that was written by Rabbi Lamb. He was someone that was always articulate, always there to write on topics that the community needed someone to address, and in many ways became a leader of the community that some call monorthodoxy. He often preferred to call centrist orthodoxy. And Rabbi Lamb, as such, was a very significant figure, not only because of his job as a president of a significant institution, but also because he was a person who wrote about a lot of very important issues. Rabbi Lamb, in that sense, and this is understood to be the case, was someone who was at times critiqued very strongly by those to his right. In the book, if any of the Chicago people, Zev Elef had a book, Dr. Zev Elef, Modern Orthodox Judaism, there's a very famous speech given by Rav Gifter in Cleveland that Rav Gifter, it's referred to sometimes as Gifter slaughters lamb for Passover. Rav Gifter gave a very, Rabbi Lamb had spoken for the Avenue Synagogue, articulated certain perspectives he had on modern orthodoxy. It was, he critiqued elements of the right, at which point Rav Gifter got out and responded very, very strongly. I'll just give you one segment of it. It was an audio recording that was transcribed in this book. I would like everything we have said here tonight to reach Lamb, not Rabbi Lamb, but Dr. Lamb. It should reach him so that he can understand where we come from. It is our duty to give thought to what is demanded of us and to tell Lamb and all his cohorts, mind your own business, go away. We are not disturbing you in the least. Do not try to disturb us. Very, very strong Lashonos here from Rav Gifter. And in many ways, that's part of what it means when you are a manhig, is that you're always open to certain critiques. And Rabbi Lamb stood very strong in terms of what he believed. And Rabbi Lamb was a person who wrote a lot of works. Torah Umada is one of the more famous ones we may be familiar with, articulating a particular ideology, a worldview in which what can a person gain from secular studies, what can a person gain from interacting in the secular world. And Rabbi Lamb, in that sense, is a figure of tremendous, tremendous importance, and one that's very, very much impacted our community in a very, very powerful way. What I want to do about tonight, though, is not Rabbi Lamb and any of his published works, nor Rabbi Lamb really as a Jewish communal figure in the classic sense, as far as decisions that he made, but speak Rabbi Lamb as one of the great darshanim. One of the great darshanim. Let me explain what I mean by that, and for us to be able to be aware of this. As we speak in general about different perspectives in tshuva, as we speak in general about how different figures, but the tshuva, so we've mentioned in the past, that sometimes people are unique because of the particular perspective they have. They say ideas that are very, very new. People that will talk about tshuva and tell you, don't think about the past that much. People that will talk about tshuva and play up the significance of Bechira Chavshis, and the messages they give being very unique. What makes certain people unique is not always the content or the token of their message, but the manner in which they do so. We spoke a bunch of years ago as an example about the Bnei Yisachar. The Bnei Yisachar is unique not because the conclusions about tshuva are necessarily so earth-shattering, although many of them are, but because of the style in which the methodology he uses in doing so. The world of remes for the Bnei Yisachar. Roshei Tevos and Sofei Tevos. Gematrias and not just, you know, Ego's Begmatria Chet, like the Ramah has, but higher level Gematrias that are very, very sort of complicated and worked out and Ramazim with the Tevos and things like that. That's one style. That one of the ways a person leaves their mark sometimes is not only by what exactly the message they give over, but the manner in which they give over that message. How do they communicate it? Some communicate it through the written work and some orally. Some, as far as, again, pshat, remez, drash, and sod, different people in different ways will speak about ideas like tshuva, and part of what we want to appreciate, and part of what often moves us, is not only what they say about tshuva, but how they say it. And certain people, how they say it, sometimes moves us much more. But Lamb is one of the great darshanim, and let me explain what that means a little bit, so we can fully appreciate it. Many of us know that Torah can be understood on multiple levels, the world of pshat, remez, drash, and sod. Source number one in the Shi, we had the opportunity a couple of years ago to speak about in greater length about Rabbi Lamb's particular perspective. Many of us know that if you just pay attention a little bit, the world of pshat is a world that has experienced a certain kind of renaissance. The world of pshat, is it pshat, is it not pshat? We live in a world in which people very much value an understanding of what pshat really is. Some mean different things when they say pshat, but people want to hear what's actually the pshat. Remez, gematrias, things like that. We live in a world in which you can hear a good deal of that. You certainly have certain people that play up the world of remez, and sod undoubtedly. The world of Torah Sanister and Torah Sakabbalah is a world which we don't have to be involved in it to know there's a whole lot going on with it. We have yeshivas that are yeshivas from Mikubalim. We have Sfarim that are coming out, Sifrei Kabbalah. We have a lot going on with that. But Lamb points out in this notes of an unrepentant darshan, Rabbi Lamb on tshuva, I will not do tshuva, says Rabbi Lamb, for the fact that I engage in drush. Drush is often a form of Torah, recognized by Chazal, invoked, used by many great Bali Machshava over the years, and it's one that sometimes people look at with a degree of like, almost it's like condescending sometimes. You say a vort and they say, but that's not pshat, and you say, I know, it's called drush, but it's not pshat. I remember speaking somewhere in a shul once, and I spoke and I said over a vort afterwards, two people, that wasn't pshat. I know, it was like a drusha. I think that means drush, like it's okay. And Rabbi Lamb, for years, gave very, very powerful drushas. Many of them have been published. And writing about how I'm comfortable with that kind of a style of Torah in which you have a good vort that may not be what the actual pshat in the pasuk is, but to construct it in a certain way. A lot of his primary impact was walking up to the pulpit and giving a drusha on Shabbos morning. Drushas Shabbos morning, depending on the shuls that we go to, some of them can be very inspiring and great, and some of them can involve people being a little bit less engaged. Certainly for many, it's not the highlight of their week from a pure, you know, Talmud Torah perspective. And that happens in some shuls more and some shuls less. Some have fantastic drushas. For Rabbi Lamb, the drushas became a dominant forum for him to be able to express his ideas in terms of what a drusha itself could really be. What I want to try to do is to go through some drushas of Rabbi Lamb to articulate some of the ideas that I think are very, very important, some insights that he has, and for us to be able to appreciate a little bit what he is doing. We'll share three or four insights. We'll try to do them in a way that they can be productive. Rabbi Lamb, as a darshan, could be very, very direct. He was not hesitant being direct. It's an unbelievable balance when you read his drushas between the timely and the timeless, as we speak about sometimes, an amazing job, ideas that are relevant for all times, an amazing job speaking to the generations, 1950s, 60s, early 70s, talking to people there in America going through particular challenges and being able to speak about those issues. People speak about the civil rights movement, people speak about Russian Jewry, a whole lot of things that are important for what many of our parents and grandparents went through and understood, and be able to do so. But let's begin as follows. We'll start with a vort from Parshas Nitzavim, because it's a good place to go. By Lamb, which is interesting, and many of us would not have thought, when you think about Neo-Hasidus, and you think about the Hasidus sort of like encroaching in the centrist or mono-Orthodox community, it is sometimes not noted, and certainly not noted enough, that Rabbi Lamb used the Torah of Hasidus all the time. Rabbi Lamb was a person who very, very much brought in a lot of Hasidus into his drushas, in a way which is not pure Hasidus always, but undoubtedly in a way which is very, very important. What, I don't have anything anyway, it's like a token gesture, I thought it was nice. Or I gave hope and then crushed it, but no. We'll go to a positive take on Tshuva right now. So he points as follows. The Alter Rebbe of Chabad, the Baal Tanya, was mechalik, as some of us may know, between two kinds of Tshuvas, Tshuva Tata and Tshuva Ilah. Lower level tshuva and higher level tshuva. Lower level and higher level tshuva. We've seen similar chilukim before in many Bali Machshava. Lower level tshuva, says the Baal HaTanya, is what's focused a little bit more on the vidoy, the charata. It's a tshuva that comes when you feel a certain sense of moral or spiritual failure. It's a tshuva that comes, and we'll see Rabbi Lamb beautiful English in terms of how he describes it. That's part of the art of a drasha, is to also use a certain kind of language. The tshuva tata comes, a certain lower level tshuva that comes when you feel like you've messed up. And now I feel like I have to confess. I feel like I've struggled, and now I feel like I have to admit it, and I have to do whatever I can to somehow rectify this situation. Tshuva tata, that's the lower level of tshuva. The higher level of tshuva has nothing to do at all with sin or defeat. It's a tshuva that comes from etzem, the fact that we are not as close as we would like to be to the Ribono Shel Olam. It's not necessarily about a certain chet. It's just the fact that we have a certain spiritual yearning, a desire to go back, not to how we were before we sinned. That's tshuva tata. Lower level tshuva in Baal Tanya is go back to where you were before you messed up. Tshuva ilah, that has to do with going back to where you were when your neshama was all the way pure, tachas kisei hakavod, when you were much more exalted in a much holier place. Tshuva ilah is a certain kind of tshuva that's not about I messed up and I feel terrible, but about an authentic desire to get closer to Ribono Shel Olam. Those are two very, very different motivating factors when you are engaged in some level in tshuva. Level one, I've messed up. Can you please forgive me? Number two, I'm just not as close as I want to be. I want a higher level existence. It's not connected to chet. As many point out, the Gemara in Pesachim describes, tshuva is created before the world's created. The idea of tshuva is not only about I sinned and I messed up. It predates all of that. Tshuva is, I have a desire to reconnect, but let me reconnect as much as possible. Which one is greater, says Rabbi Lam, tshuva tata or tshuva ilah? Lichora, it's very clear, by etzem, the words, there's lower level tshuva and higher level tshuva. The lower level tshuva has to be, not getting too fancy, lower than the higher level tshuva. Tshuva tata, if it's only about how I messed up and I feel bad, that's one thing. If it's about desiring a relationship, that's something else. Rabbi Lam points out, when you look in the Psukim and Parsha Nitzavim, they're actually structured in the opposite order. They're structured first about a tshuva ilah. The Psukim that describe tshuva here in this week's Parsha first describe a tshuva which has to do with the desire to come back to Ribono Shel Olam, has to do with a tshuva where a person wants to get. Let me see if I can find it right now. That's okay. Shouldn't be that hard, no? It's not like the longest parsha in the world. It opens up a little bit. Avishavta ad Hashem Elokecha. It opens up a little bit with a desire of a person who is in a much, much higher place, a person that wants a certain connection, a person that wants a striving with the Ribono Shel Olam. But when you look at Epsukim Zion through Yud and Perek Lamed, so there we shift a little bit. Now we have a person that wasn't listening to Hashem, a person that was struggling, and now they're repenting. Ask Rabbi Lam the following question. This is, if tshuva ila'a is a higher level of tshuva, and tshuva tata is a lower level of tshuva, so why do the psukim and parsha Nitzavim reverse the order? That's this question. It's not about pshat of what the pasuk actually means, but understand the structure. If lower level tshuva is you messed up and you sinned, I feel bad, and then higher level tshuva is, let me now get closer, have a relationship. Why do the psukim and parsha Nitzavim reverse the order? Why begin with the tshuva v'shavta ad Hashem Elokecha, this desire to get closer to Hashem, and only afterwards relate to the lower level of tshuva of a person who messed up and sinned, and a person who feels it's a failure, and now they're coming back? Rabbi Lam makes a suggestion, it's one that we suggested yesterday in the context of Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Lam says as follows, maybe the pshat's like this. There's sometimes a difference, and here's the practical, the drush, it's a practical nekuda that's very helpful. There is sometimes a difference between what is higher level and what is lower level, and the order in which you should go, you should follow them. There's sometimes, he says, Aliba de Emes, tshuva ila'a is higher level. And what can make the argument, first talk about the lower level and then the higher level. Lower level ends, I messed up, I feel bad, and then tshuva ila'a. But sometimes, when you yourself, that's from the perspective of the Ribono Shel Olam, tshuva ilah is higher. The psukim and parsha Nitzavim, they're Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to Klal Yisrael. And when Moshe Rabbeinu speaks to Klal Yisrael, he wants Klal Yisrael to first understand the following. Tshuva ilah. Understand what we are ultimately striving for. Understand what we want more than anything else. Understand the connection that we have. And says Rabbi Lam, when you've done that well, then you can go back to your tshuva tata. Says Rabbi Lam, look at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I told us last night. I wish I knew it yesterday. Look at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah is all focused on Tshuva Ilah. It's all about the Malchus of the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's all about the closeness, the striving for a relationship with Hashem that we want to begin to cultivate or continue to cultivate in Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur is all about the lower level Tshuva. Yom Kippur is all about the vidoy of the messing up and the sin and the feeling of failure. Why is it structured that way? And then Yom Kippur? Because first understand what you're striving for. First understand what you want of a Tshuva Ilah. And when you understand what you want of a Tshuva Ilah, so then the Yom Kippur, when you finally do confess your sins, it's a radically different Tshuva than now you're confessing where you're at. When I know where I want to go, I don't feel bad that I messed up. I know what I want, and these things are making it harder for me to get there. Then come Yom Kippur, my tshuva tata, my tshuva where I confess my sins, is very, very different. Ein odome the person that when Yom Kippur comes, their tshuva is only about the fact that they messed up in certain sins, and they just feel bad about that. And the tshuva of one that views it in the context of tshuva ilah, of the context of one that really wants a powerful relationship. Ein odome. They're so incredibly different. They're so incredible. When I feel bad because I want a relationship. Not just feel bad because I let myself down, but I feel bad because I want a certain kind of relationship. But Lamb goes on, let's go with another drasha, a very, very well-known one. With the following observation, it's an unbelievable Rosh Hashanah insight, and it's one where Lamb, I think, describes very well with good insight where we're at. He writes as follows, it's in source number four on the sheet. Ours is an age which has forgotten to cry. Whether Rosh Hashanah services or Tisha B'Av kinos, whether at a funeral or theater, tears are conspicuous by their absence. Once upon a time, the machzor was stained with tears. Today, it is so white and clean and cold. There was a time, great schusa, my grandmother has elements of this, where Yif people who cry. They cry, yamim no ram time, yamim no ram time. You hear tears, yamim no ram time. My wife described to me her first time davening here in Chalavim. You have some of the older Rebbetzins are like mamish crying for real. It's powerful. Machzorim and kinos that are drenched with tears. Many of says Rabbi Lam, and this is not Rabbi Lam Hara, but it's an astute Hara. The idea of crying is one that is not as common. And sometimes when a person cries, they're even embarrassed that they're crying. That crying, we sometimes, the way Rabbi Lam describes it, we sometimes think that if we cover up our tears, that means that we're not feeling anything. That we sometimes think if we're not as expressive, that means that we're all good. And that's not true. We want to be people who are emotionally in touch and people who are comfortable coming into having an experience where you cry. That machlokas between the Arizal and the Grud, you cry in Rosh Hashanah. So for so many, Rabbi Lam would say, it's like an abstract hypothetical question. Like crying in Rosh Hashanah, like what are you talking about? I haven't cried in so long. I haven't experienced a tear in so long. Like how could that really be? And there's something here, Lam, about understanding crying. And Rabbi Lam describes how in Rosh Hashanah, there are three people who cry and that are associated with Rosh Hashanah, and it's beautiful in terms of what he describes. The first person that we associate with Rosh Hashanah that cries is the mother of Sisera. Aim Sisera cries, her son, a general, trying to attack Klal Yisrael. He's eventually killed. When his mother finds out that her son, the general, has been killed, what does she do? So she peers intently out of the window, wondering what's going to happen. When she finds out the truth must emerge, her son is dead. What does she do? Uncontrollable sobbing. According to Gemara, there are 100 tears. She cried 100 times. Those 100 tears are the reason why we blow shofar 100 times. Crying number one, Rosh Hashanah, the mother of Sisera. The mother of Sisera cries, says Rabbi Lam, because she lived in a delusional reality. Sometimes a person can live in a reality where you think everything's great, everything's always going to be okay. My son is a general, nothing will ever happen to him. You live in a reality where everything's always going to be utopian and perfect. And then sometimes when that reality hits, and it's not actually that way, you break down and you cry. It's a crying that comes when you live in a delusional reality and then it just hits you. It hits you that it really wasn't the way that you always thought it was. That's one kind of crying. When you live in an unrealistic world, I think everything's always going to be perfect, everything's always going to be great, and then boom, something hits you, and you break down. We blow shofar 100 times in Rosh Hashanah, part of that is about, for the Rambam, a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call about not living in a delusional reality. It's a wake-up call that tells you, don't assume everything's always going to be perfect, everything's always going to be wonderful. It's a wake-up call that says, we got to work hard today. We got to work hard today. This is a real place. Don't make the mistake of Aim Sisera, where you fall apart there. There's another crying that takes place in Rosh Hashanah. That comes from the Kriyas Torah on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. The Kriyas Torah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, we read about Hagar. We read about Hagar. Hagar was sent out by Sarai Imenu. She went out with Yishmael to the desert. When the water in her jug gave out, she cast the child away, pathetically saying she did not want to see him die. And she raised her voice and cried. Hagar was alone in the desert. Hagar was sitting there, and she has her son. The water runs out, and Hagar puts her kid away and starts to cry. She gives away Yishmael, and she starts to cry. Hagar's tears are the opposite of the mother of Sisera's. Sisera's mother cries because she's not in touch with reality. Hagar cries because she is too in touch with reality. Hagar looks at the situation and says it is dire. Hagar looks at the situation and says, there is nothing that I can do. My kid is going to die. She gives up and she starts crying. Sometimes a person cries when they become so in touch with reality that they become pessimistic, that they assume nothing can ever change, and you cry sometimes when you've given up. There's a crying of Rosh Hashanah, the tears of the mother of Sisera, when you live in a delusional reality and then you realize, I gotta wake up. It may not always be this way. I don't want to come too late and I break down from tears. I couldn't handle it. There's a crying of Hagar, which takes place when you cry with Hagar when it looks like you're totally hopeless. There's nothing I can do, so all I do is break down and cry. Those are two kinds of tears that some of us may have experienced ourselves. There may have been tears in times where something hit us. It was a real challenge. And we start crying because it changed our reality. I couldn't have imagined this would ever happen. And there are also some of us, sometimes, you can experience a tear when you feel like, there's just nothing I can do. My situation is what my situation is, and there's nothing I can do. Says Rabbi Lam so beautifully on Rosh Hashanah, we read about a third person who cries. The third person who cries in the Haftorah Rosh Hashanah is Rachel, who's Mevaka al Banah. Rachel's cry is the Jewish cry. Rachel's tears are the tears that we hope we have. They're the tears that describe what we're striving for. Vatima'ein lechinachem, I believe the pasuk says. Rachel refused to be comforted. It took him in Sefer Yirmiyah. Rachel is mevaka al banah. Rachel is in touch with the reality. Rachel knows Klal Yisrael is going into galus, but her tears are not the tears of giving up of Hagar. Her tears are realistic, but they're not giving up. Her tears are the tears that have taken Klal Yisrael through Dore Doros. Her tears are the tears of the Shavu Vanim the Gvulam. Her tears are the tears that you cry when they are tears. I'll read it from Rabbi Lam. Here is a woman whose tears have moved history. Unlike Sisera's mother, they do not come from living an easy life and deluding herself into imagining that a day of reckoning will never come. Rachel lived a hard life and a brief one. She knew trouble and anguish. She sees her children going into the exile and recognizes the bitterness of reality. But unlike Hagar, she refuses to bow to these realities. So, me'ana lehinachem. She refuses to submit. She refuses to adjust. She refuses to accept exile and destruction as a last word. Her cry, her tears, her protest to God are the characteristic of the Jew throughout all times. The Jewish soul beholds reality in all its ugliness, but sets out to transform it. The tears of Rachel, again, these are tears that remind us of what's the reality and how we can change it. That things aren't good, but we're going to cry, and we're never going to be comforted because we're never going to accept it. We're always going to continue to build, and we're always going to try to continue to do whatever we can. Says Rabbi Lam as follows, there are elements in our door. We need to learn how to cry the way Rachel learned how to cry. To learn how to be people who are emotionally engaged, to learn how to be people who are sensitive to what's going on, but are never going to give up at that reality. Rabbi Lam here describes American Jewry. I'll give you an updated example of it. Many of us know, I'm sure, that if you look at the current state of American Jewry, so American Jewry, broadly defined, we're not in a great place. The Orthodox community, we're strong demographically. We're doing well. But if you look at Reform, Conservative Jewry, they're not that great. Intermarriage rates are growing. The rates of assimilation are staggering and scary. And a person can look at elements of the American seaboard. I imagine it's true in British Jewry in a similar way. A person can look at American Jewry and you can want to cry. But there are different kinds of cries. Number one is to realize, not like Aim Sisra, this delusional reality where everything will always be perfect. Don't worry, everything will always work out. You also don't want to cry the way that Hagar cried over that. We don't want to cry and say, what can we do? It is the way it is, and nothing's ever going to change. That this is how it is, I'll just give it up, that's the reality, and I'll cry, and I'll cry over the fact that it's really all over. The cries of Rachel is the cry of embracing a reality, but never being willing to give up. Never to be willing to be comforted or to assume the reality that we see is the reality that must continue. It never has to be that way. It never has to be that way. And part of Rosh Hashanah is learning, number one, just how to be emotionally engaged, but number two, to strive for the form of emotional engagement, which is not the tears of having given up, the tears of when your delusional reality gets hit, but the tears that come from hope, the tears that come from, I will just never give up. I will vayimah ein lehinachem. I can never, never be comforted. Part of Rabbi Lam on Tshuva, the art of the drasha, looking at the three different ways people cry in Rosh Hashanah and comparing them in that way, it's very, very beautiful Torah. It's very beautiful Torah. Part of it's to understand, where do I want to go? That's step one. Tshuva tata and tshuva ilah. Number two, how do I get there? A sensitivity to the emotional. A sensitivity to tears. Being able to cry, but not to cry in a way or to make the mistake of believing that tears mean that there's a problem, that tears mean that you're weaker, that tears mean that anything is wrong. A person who cries has the capacity to... It's expressing where you're at emotionally. You're emotionally engaged and emotionally in touch. And when you do so in a way like Rachel Imenu, the Jewish tears, we all have tears in our lives that fall into all three categories. But there's an element sometimes of a Jewish tears, which are hopeful, which are not going to be comforted, which are the tears that come when a person wants to be able to move on. And that's what we need. I think in a certain sense, if we can keep on just going from Sifrei Rabbi Lam, in his Haggadah, Rabbi Lam has something which is very, very beautiful, and it gives insight also into where the struggle is at as far as tshuva goes. Who are we talking to? So we know where we want to go, and we know that we want to be emotionally engaged. But who are we talking to? Who are the people that aren't always as successful? So Rabbi Lam has a beautiful description as to who the Rasha is on Leil HaSeder. The Rasha often, if you look at Haggadah, the people that do this, who trace, like, a lot of Haggadahs have pictures in them. So if you trace the pictures in different Haggadahs and what the Rasha looks like, you find some very, very intriguing things. Like, you have to describe the Rasha. Like, you know, go online and find a picture of, like, the paradigmatic Rasha, who he looks like. So different Haggadahs have different kinds of images. Rabbi Lam argues that some of them, you know, I don't know what it would look like nowadays, but some of them are often not that true. There are certain people, Rabbi Lam thinks, we have to categorize in the category of Rasha, but not a Rasha in the sense of being wicked or evil, the way sometimes we are. There are many people today who openly violate many sacred Jewish institutions, yet are proud to be a Jew. You have people who are openly Jewish, but don't keep that much Torah and mitzvos. They may dismiss Jewish observances. They say it's anachronistic. That made sense in medieval times, but why do that nowadays? Like, really? I still have to watch Negel Vassar? Come on. Where are the evil spirits and the Ruach Ra that are floating around? It's not the only reason why I watch Negel Vassar in the morning, but that's one. You have people who are good-natured, intelligent, sympathetic, and in their innermost hearts, preciously Jewish. You can have people who are a Rasha, but they're not. There's no Rishas. There's no evil there. They're more the opposite of the Chacham. The Chacham is wise and intelligent. The Rasha often is mistaken. Good people, but not evil people. Good people, but not people who are fundamentally doing terrible, terrible things. It's not to wickedness, but fundamental mistakenness. The failures of the Rasha is intellectual, not moral. They want to be good people, and they are good people. Many times, if we want to just even dissect ourselves for a second, we make the mistake of when we imagine why a person sins and why a person messes up, and here's one of the great insights of Rav Kook also in Maamar Hador, that we sometimes make the following mistake. We group things together too much, says Rav Kook and says Rabbi Lam. I'll go with the Rav Kook insight from Maamar Hador. We'll speak about this probably next on Wednesday, but we'll share it now anyway. Rav Kook went as follows. There were a lot of generations in which people who were less frum were also less moral and less ethical. That what it meant to be non-religious meant that you fell in lots of different areas. That you were also, again, less moral and less ethical, less helpful. You were more hedonistic. I cared only about myself and my own personal pleasure. That's not true, says Rav Kook, in his generation. It's not true in ours that much. You have a whole lot of people who are not as religious, but they're not evil. They're not wicked. It's hard to call them rishayim in the classic sense of the term. They're good, moral, upright, ethical, solid people. The community, you take elements of American Jews, wait for a second, who are people sometimes who are not keeping Torah mitzvot, certainly as we understand it. But are they engaged in tikkun olam? Are they trying to be moral, ethical, and upright people? For sure they are. For sure they are. That sometimes when you understand the idea of a, let's be magdir, the community, Rabbi Lam, as a communal figure. Let's talk about tshuva, not only as far as us as individuals, but let's look at a community and define a community. When you look at a community a certain way, when you look at what it is that you have certain people who are not keeping Torah mitzvos, understand them. And understand, when you understand them well, you will understand better how to respond and how to react. The ultimate mission with a Rasha like this, he's not a person who's immoral. He's a person that doesn't fully understand the value of certain things. The special kind of lovable Rasha, quote unquote, is fairly common nowadays. Not pervasively, but sometimes I mess up. Hopefully when I mess up, it's not a function of too much. Hopefully if you mess up, it's not a function of being immoral or unethical or breakdown like that. Sometimes it's not connected. And sometimes we're just not there the way we should be. And sometimes it's a sin that comes not from rishus, but from not being sufficiently achach. Not being sufficiently wise, not being sufficiently wise and insightful. How do we respond to him? Hagadah tells us, argue with him, debate with him, teach him, educate him. Show him that his scale of values is completely distorted, and that the argument from convenience is unworthy of an intelligent person. Make your case. But make your case. We're not going to get there by yelling, and we're not going to get there by anything other than let's engage in conversation intellectually to push our side. Let's articulate our side of a hierarchy of certain values. A hierarchy of values. Teach him that when there are questions that can be answered. But Lam here is describing the way that you relate to a broader cloud and the world in which we live, in which people are often good people who just aren't engaged in Torah mitzvot. And the way we respond is by educating. You want to lead others to tshuva? It's not by putting them down. It's not by thinking that I should cry the way Hagar cries because it's the reality and I can't change it. It's not by being like Aim Sisera, it's the delusional reality of like everyone's perfect, everyone's all good. The way that we deal, we believe that people can change. We believe people have the capacity to do so. We cry, we are never going to give up until we finally come back. Says Rabbi Lam, understand, so who are you working with? How am I going to do it? Develop your plan. What's my plan for how I'm going to do so? What does it look like to interact with certain people? And that's true for us also as individuals. What's your plan? What is your plan? What is the way? Why do I mess up sometimes? Where does it come from and how can I fix it? That's one of the first steps to be able to do so, to be able to do so as much as possible. I want to pause with you so far and end with one more ha'ara from this week's parsha from Rabbi Lam, and then we'll just conclude there. We saw the following thus far. There's a certain kind of Torah. This is Torah that's not, it's not halachic Torah. It's Torah that's not Kabbalistic, nor we learn just like pshuto shel mikra. It's Torah that's trying to use Chumash. It's trying to learn from Chumash. It's trying to learn from our davening. Different insights from our Haggadah. Different insights that are going to be helpful. Russia, let's define Russia a little bit differently. Let's be able to understand where things are really at. Let's talk about, number one, different categories of tshuva and the way, practically, we should go there. Rosh Hashanah starts by articulating a vision. Yom Kippur ends with tshuva tata, focusing on some of your individual needs to engage in vidui, to confess my sins. That's part of what it's about. That's part of what the vidui of Yom Kippur is about. Let's understand that if we want to be able to get there, we have to be emotionally engaged and aware of the fact that we should never give up or distort or pretend like everything is always going to be perfect. Let's learn from Rachli Menu how to cry. Let's learn from Rachli Menu how to be engaged and how to hope to build in a different direction. And as you're building, as you have your vision from Rosh Hashanah, as you're building with the tears and the hope and the understanding that faith can continue to grow, so please understand, dissect who are you working with, if it's with others, and where are you at? We're not bad people if we mess up. We're good people. People that want to be good, moral, ethical people that sometimes have challenges. Let's understand why that's so and attack that and figure out how that works. Rabbi Lamb, in another drasha in Parshas Nitzavim, it's a fantastic and very, very simple question. It's one that we would undoubtedly, I think, be able to relate to. Torah tells us here in the discussion of tshuva, Perek Lamed Pasuk Aleph, the way that many Rishonim think it's about tshuva. Vayaki avo alecha kol dvar ma'ela, bracha v'akala, it's about tshuva, asher sati lefanecha, v'ashi vose el vavecha. When you want to engage in tshuva, where do you go? Where do you go when you want to engage in tshuva? Go back to your heart. Go back to your heart. The emotional side, your heart is a good place. Let's go there. Says Rabbi Lamb, I'm not sure the heart's that good. I have a question. We say in Kriya Shema, don't follow your heart. You follow your heart, you go to a bad place. So what is it? Are hearts a good place to go to or a bad place to go to? To ask it differently, man is fundamentally good. Go back to your heart. Go there and everything will be good. Or man is fundamentally bad. We're created poor. And don't trust your heart. Don't go back there at all. Ask Rabbi Lamb a very simple question. So which is it? Which is it? The heart is good or the heart is bad? What really is it? Rabbi Lamb suggests, again, with stripping away some of it, suggests something which is very, very simple. Chazal described the Yetzer Hara as, obviously Yetzer Hara is bad, but Chazal Darshan also, Tov Me'od, is a reference to the Yetzer Hara. There's an element to the Yetzer Hara which is bad, and there's an element to the Yetzer Hara which is good. What does that mean? Yetzer Hara is good or is it bad? Which one really is it? So the Lamb offers the following suggestion, and it gets to the core as to what it means to go back to your heart and what it means to not follow your heart. Says Rabbi Lamb as follows. It's in his drasha on Parshas Nitzavim, the first one. It's also an insight from the Baal Tanya. There are two ways that you deal with Yetzer Hara. This is so true, and it's so important. One way to deal with Yetzer Hara is to try to just go at all out battle with Yetzer Hara. I'm going to fight it. I'm going to defeat it. It's a melchama, and I'm going to win. That's one mahalach. You read Mesil Shasharim sometimes. Mesil Shasharim is about a mechama with the Yetzer Hara. Another mahalach in Yetzer Hara, he goes from the Baal Tanya, it's in the Tzadok. Tzadok, at length, it was a couple years ago. Tzadok thinks that part of Yetzer Hara is learning how to channel your Yetzer Hara. We have desires. Yetzer Hara is what gets the world going. Yetzer Hara is what gives us a certain motivation. Yetzer Hara is a person, to paraphrase the Gemara Masech Shabbos, a person that their Yetzer Hara is to be violent, so I shift that violence. Not that I'm fighting it to become compassionate. I shift that violence to become a shochet. I shift that violence to become a moel. It's about dealing with who you are and knowing how to channel that as well as possible. Knowing how to channel that in the best way that we possibly can. To be able to know how to shift things on some level. Says Rabbi Lamb as follows. Your heart... In your heart, those real desires that we have deep down inside, if you don't know what you're doing, they have the capacity to lead us astray. They have the capacity to lead us in a very, very tricky place. That don't follow your heart when it's leading you in a bad direction. But that same heart with the same kochos to lead you in a bad direction, if you know how to channel things, you know how to use things, the way the Piazzetzer describes it in one place, if I know, as an example, that I'm a fiery kind of a person, I'm a fiery personality, so channel that towards Hislavas. Channel that towards a certain passion in your Yiddishkeit. And we can think about people sometimes who probably at a certain stage naturally are very strong and fiery, and they've learned how to channel that in ways in which there's greater Kedusha. And you can have people sometimes who naturally are maybe Balei Gaiva, and they've learned how to channel that to a healthy dose of self-confidence that they have said, I will go right now and help others. The gaiva that's not, I'm better than you. The gaiva is, I have something I can do right now, and if there's a problem, therefore, I'll be the first guy there to try and solve it. I'll be the first one there to try to do it. Vashevosa elevavecha means that when a person wants to do tshuva, and when a person wants to be good, understand the following. Are we fundamentally good or fundamentally bad? We have kochos that can lead us in bad directions. But a person who knows what they're doing can find vashevosa elevavecha, how to use and channel that which is in your heart, that yitzhahara which is inside, those traits that we have sometimes are not as perfect as we would ideally like, and how to channel them. It's significantly easier in a certain sense than radically changing elements of personality, which sometimes is too hard and sometimes a little bit dangerous. If a person's fiery, channel that towards Kedusha. A person's a little bit of Vaga, channel that towards Kedusha. To be able to use, understand who we are and to channel that effectively, that's part of what we're trying to do. It's part of what we're striving for. It's part of what we're, when we're ambitious, what we're hoping to be able to accomplish. Tshuva is very, very difficult. And tshuva demands, on one level, that we understand who we are. We understand who we are. We understand what we struggle with. We understand where we want to go. The mistake, we never want to give up. We never want to be delusional about things. We want to be able to be hopeful. We want to be able to be understanding. We want to be able to understand that each of us, in our own way, has that capacity for tshuva. Should have a wonderful Shabbos. We should prepare for Rosh Hashanah, which Rosh Hashanah gives us a vision of where we could be, an opportunity to become emotionally engaged with the day and with my future and the future of those around me, an opportunity to gain a certain kind of clarity and insight, to understand how vashivosa elevavecha, there are elements of me that can go in different directions, and I want to learn how I can channel them in the right way. And then when a Yom Kippur comes and we're engaged in the vidui, it's a totally different vidui. When I have my vision, when I know how to channel things, when I know what I can accomplish and where I can go, when I sit there with the vidui, then it's a radically, radically different vidui. To all of you, a ksiv chesima tova. I hope it should be a good year. It should be a good Rosh Hashanah. It should be a wonderful opportunity. We look forward to a great year together of learning Torah, of growing, and really just having the opportunity to be able to learn together and to benefit from each other's company throughout. It's been a pleasure thus far in Chodesh Elul, and we hope very much that continues. But again, Aksiva v'chasima tova.